I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to a very special edition of Words on a Wire, because I am sitting in the studio not only with two fantastic writers and scholars and thinkers, but two very good friends, Marcia Hatfield Dottis, and we also have in the studio another very good friend of mine, Mimi R. Gladstein. Tell Marcia, welcome back. Words on a Wire, this isn't your first time. We've even done shows together.
That's right. It's great to be back, Daniel.
And it's good to see you in the studio, especially now that I know you're leaving El Paso. No, it can't be true. You've been here, what, 30 years?
35 years.
35 years, and you're leaving. How does that feel?
Odd, but with Howard having retired from UTEP after 44 years, we're going up where we have a gigantic mob of family.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
Oh, how wonderful. Well, congratulations. We're going to miss you. And Mimi, welcome back to Words on a Wire. You've been on the show before.
Yes,
too.
I have, Daniel. Thank you. And I think you and I have sort of done a few projects together, too.
That's right. And I'm going to mention that when I talk about your bio in a second. Everybody in El Paso's literary, intellectual, even social activist community knows you two, but not everybody in all of Radiolandia knows you. So I'm just going to read a quick bio. I mean, you guys are both nationally, internationally known scholars and writers, but let's give them a little background about exactly who you are. Okay? I'm going to read from the book. By the way, today we're going to talk about your new book, The Women of Smeltertown. Marcia Hatfield Dottisdahl is most recently the co-author with writer and photographer Bill Wright of Authentic Texas, People of the Big Bend, which, by the way, is a beautiful book, 2014 Southwest Book Award of the Border Regional Library Association winner. She is editor of Grace and Gumption, The Women of El Paso, Literary El Paso, which won the Southwest Book Award and the Border Regional Library Association. And I could go on and on because you have a lot of credits and awards, but welcome, Marcia. And Mimi Gladstein is professor of English here at UTEP and has chaired both English and theater and dance departments. I believe you were also a dean one time. When I first interviewed here, you were a dean.
Yes, and I also was the first director of the Women's Studies program, you know.
And the first female professor to wear pants.
That's true.
I love when you tell that story about coming to school wearing pants and the reaction you got.
Well, you know, once upon a time, the dean of students would send female students home if they came on campus in pants.
That's incredible. That is crazy. And you are the co-editor of The Last Supper of Chicano Heroes, Selected Works of Jose Antonio Burciaga, and that's our little project that we did together. I'm the co-editor, and we won the American Book Award on that, the Southwest Book Award, the Latino Book Award. And your scholarly articles have been translated into Spanish, Japanese, Swahili, I believe, a few of those. But welcome! And we're here to talk about your new book, The Women of Smeltertown. What a beautiful book. Why don't you first maybe start by telling me how this book came about?
Well, Mimi had been wanting us to do a project for quite a while because she was in Grace and Gumption. She, just like you, Daniel, were in Literary El Paso.
Right.
So when I got out from under Authentic Texas, she said, well, let's do a project. And I had learned a valuable lesson from Bill Wright on Authentic Texas. When Literary El Paso came out, he was in it, came to my house like all the featured authors did for a party.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill said, well, now that you're not at Texas Western Press anymore, let's do a project. And I thought, yeah, let's do lunch or whatever. He said, no, really. And he said, what have you been thinking about? Which is when I said, I've been to Valentine, Texas 3 times, and I've never seen a human being. So what makes people come here and what makes them stay? So when Mimi said, let's do a project, I said, here's what I've been thinking about. I said, I've been here since 1983, and the houses in Smeltertown were already torn down. But the smelter was still active.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, every day when I passed the smelter round trip going to UTEP, I wondered, what was it like to raise children there, to establish a home there? We know that a lot of the buildings and the homes were very primitive. Brian Woolley called them adobe shacks in the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
So I wondered, what was day-to-day life like?
Can you give us a little background, either one of you, on what is Smeltertown, just for context?
Well, the American Smelting and Refining Company attracted workers, many from Mexico. And the original thing that we think of as Smeltertown was a group of little houses, or as Brian said, adobe shacks, built along the bank of the Rio Grande. And, you know, one person would come from one little community, mm-hmm. and then their relatives would come. We thought those houses belonged to them. One of the interesting things we found was, no, those houses belong to other people, and the improvements that these people made on those houses, when they moved out, they lost all that.
What was the business of Smeltertown? What did they do there? I remember the giant smokestacks, and in one part of the book, you guys say that it, at one time, was the tallest industrial tower in the world, which is amazing. But I remember that tower or towers when I first moved in. Of course, they were knocked out, I think, in 2012. You right?
Yeah.
But what did they do there? What exactly is smeltering?
They did copper and lead refining. And copper was in demand. They were one of the largest copper smelters in the world. Uh-huh. And Mimi's right. Most of the people in El Paso thought that those homes were actually owned by ASARCO.
Right.
They were not. They were owned by individual landlords. And you did not have to work at the smelter to live there.
Oh, exploitation much? Right.
They paid a nominal rent for a nominal residence.
Right.
So extended families moved there. What ASARCO owned was an area called Smelter Terrace.
That was the rich side of town, right?
Well, what was wonderful, I'll turn it over to Mimi. Mimi went to school with the women who grew up in Smelter Terrace, who really didn't have much to do with the actual dwellings below.
Now, the focus of this book is on the women of Smeltertown, those that lived in Smeltertown during this time. And they didn't usually work for the smelter. They were teachers, housewives, and those are who you interviewed. Did you get to interview any of your friends or people that you knew from the school?
Yes, exactly. We had a lot of help. One of the people who was able to put us in touch with a lot of people, of course, is Rosa Guerrero, who knows mm-hmm. everybody.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I don't know her. Of course, I'm not anybody. No, I'm kidding.
But anyway, I was actually went to parties in Smelter Terrace.
Did you?
Yeah, when I was going, because these people went to El Paso High.
Right.
And so the management had really nice houses, and they had a lake there.
Right.
An artificial lake. And
really?
So,
wow, how nice.
And so we were able to contact, actually, when I knew her, she was Betty Woodside, but she likes to be called Elizabeth Welch now.
Mm.
But she was very helpful and generous. She sent us pictures of her and her sister and brother at the lake in front of their house. We also interviewed Peggy Walters. She had lived there, but they were the management people.
Right.
And they lived up on the actual grounds, like, of the smelter.
Right.
But then there was also some part of it that was like a, more like a tenement.
Mm-hmm.
Tenement apartments.
Tenement apartments.
El Alto.
Yeah, El Alto. And there was a
El Bajo, wasn't it?
No, El Bajo is the one below.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, this is El Alto.
Oh,
Alto,
we're still up. We're still on the Alto. Okay.
The Alto. Anyway, and they had a church there.
Oh, wow.
And the church burned. And then when they reconstructed it, in El Bajo.
Which was, yeah, I wanted to ask you guys about that because it's really beautiful image that you write of Smelter Terrace. And at one point, you're describing it as a place that was really hard to find. That you go on these little roads and there's trees and suddenly there's these very nice houses and a lake. And I really love your description. And then what way on the bottom is Bajo?
El Bajo.
El Bajo. And that's where the poorest of the workers and their families lived. And then there's a couple of places in between.
Like La Calavera was located right next to Skull Canyon and over by the cemetery. Now, other areas like...
there was a cemetery.
There still is.
Wow. Can people visit it?
Yes, but some of the graves, they can't find them now.
Right.
But we included a poem by Ben Sines called The Color Blue.
Right.
Which is a woman speaking from her grave in the Smeltertown Cemetery. It's
right.
Lovely.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to point out the photographs that the women who were raised in Smelter Terrace and upper management homes, the photographs of them are your typical, what we imagined is 1950s, almost drug out from a sitcom. You know, very well-dressed mamas.
Beautiful pictures. Yeah.
Stay-at-home mamas. They're perfect little kids. But then there's a photograph of a primitive home in El Bajo with a woman and her little children with a completely dirt yard a falling down fence.
Wow.
So the contrast is just killing. But at one time, Smeltertown had a lot of stuff going on. They had a doctor, had a small hospital, had a little fire department.
They had a vocational school.
Yes.
And actually, you know, one of the things that we learned is that Cristo Rey was born in the church in El Bajo in Smeltertown.
What do you mean?
Well, the priest there got the idea for it.
Oh, okay. Cristo Rey is a mountain. Well, part of it's in El Paso, part of it's in Mexico, and part of it's in New Mexico. And you can see it from almost anywhere on the west side. It's got a cross on this.
It has a statue sculpted by Ubichi Soler,
oh,
who I believe did the Rio de Janeiro Christ of the Andes.
Okay.
But it started out as just a wooden cross made by the boys at the vocational school.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Then it became an iron cross, and then the priest got the idea of asking Ubichi Soler to sculpt it. And, you know, there's a lot of people who've written about the creation of it, but we also added the role the women played.
Right, right.
How they took baskets of rocks up for them, how they fed the men as they were working. So it was a very interesting project.
Well, we approached the project being very logical about it. There's six chapters. So Mimi and I divided them up.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm being Venido's Making Our Homes and Hard Times about the strikes. Mimi, say yours.
And I'm Food for the Spirit, which is about, and there's several churches that are still very active.
Mm-hmm.
And the St. Jude's in Pacific Park has pieces of the original church that was in Smeltertown that got torn down.
And Santa Teresita in Buena Vista.
They have one of the people we got to interview was Angelina Rivers, and she actually lives in Albany, New York. And she always would bring a quilt for them to auction off at the bazaar every year. So the thing about it that's so wondrous is that whole idea, that comunidad, that sense that these people had of their community.
Right, right.
And you know, who put us in touch with a lot of people was Beto Lopez, because Beto's father was the head of the Y in Smeltertown.
Oh, wow.
They didn't live there, but he was the head of the Y.
And Mimi's other two chapters were In and Out of the Kitchen. And what was the last one?
Adios.
Adios. There you go.
So that's how you guys did it. You had six chapters and you split them up and then you would review each other's and add comments. That's kind of what we did when we were. Yeah.
But what we also did, we have a terrific introduction by Yolanda Chavez-Leyva.
Right.
And we have an afterword by Howard Campbell.
Right. I was going to ask you about that because then you have that opening poem by Benjamin Alida Sainz. All these literary intellectual figures are connected to the University of Texas El Paso and the larger El Paso community. And it gives the whole book a sense of, you know, it really enhances the sense of community overall, that this is a very meaningful part of the history of El Paso. But why did you include so many voices of so many El Pasans?
Well, one voice we included, there's a short story in my chapter, Hard Times, by Brian Woolley.
Mm-hmm.
When he was here, he was starting his career as a newspaperman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he went on award-winning novelist, everything. And he was just starting out, and he was told when it was raining, the strike had gone on forever at Asarco. This is the one, this is the worst strike, where the workers gave up and went back to work.
Right.
But his editor at the Herald Post said, I want you to go down there and cover the strike. Well, it's raining. He had a brand new used car. So he calls a cab and tells the cab driver to take him there. And he says, wait here for me. And the cab driver said no and drove away and stranded him down there. Well, he ended up being accepted by them just on that one visit.
Oh, wow.
And his story is about going to one of the workers' houses whose daughter had polio. In the course of the strike, she outgrew her brace, and they couldn't afford another one.
Yeah.
And he's the only reference I ever saw, as I said, that called the houses what they were, adobe shacks. Now, there is a seminal work on Asarco that Monica Perales did.
Mm-hmm.
She's from UTEP. It came from her dissertation.
Mm-hmm.
But it concentrated more in a global sense that it was the men's experience.
Right.
And the women were in there because it was also about her family.
Right.
But this one is only concentrating on the women and their stories and the stories that came from their adult children. But I really want to stress right here that we're so grateful to have gotten the stories because four of our ladies have passed away.
Wow.
So it's so important that if you want to know something
right.
and you're really curious about it, go find it out. Get people to tell you stories.
Oh,
don't
I love
you
that.
Think,
Mimi? That's wonderful, wonderful advice. You know, and the fact that I think that's what makes this book so important and so necessary, the fact that it is about the women of Smeltertown. You know, we've heard a lot about Smeltertown and places like this, but I'm wondering how the lives that you uncovered and the day-to-day things in the kitchen. And then there's also this wonderful metaphor. I mean, I know you know, it's an actual detail, but I love the metaphorical value of it about how the women in Smelter Terrace would immediately start planting flowers and, you know, vegetation to kind of make it there. What does these lives and these experiences of women reflect about El Paso in general? And well, and actually just the women in the world at that time.
I think women can always be counted on to make where they live a home.
Mm.
So it was the women that were in El Alto in the tenement apartments that planted all the flowers and did all of those things. You know, I think.
Yeah, and the thing, too, is, for example, we went up to Buena Vista. They have a little park there that's maybe more beautiful than any of the larger parks in El Paso.
Right.
You know, and they maintain the homes there are lovely. But, of course, the homes there are very different than the homes down in El Bajo were rented homes. But these, you could actually buy property and build your home in Buena Vista.
Mm-hmm.
And Pacific Park. And that was always... I know that Mimi and I have commented on this a million times. It almost seemed like that was a side benefit of a strike, because if they got a lump sum, then they would immediately go to buy a piece of land in Buena Vista or Pacific Park, and then they'd start building their own homes, and then they would leave Smeltertown, although they would still be working there. And a lot of people that lived in El Bajo also worked at the cement plant. And the reason Smeltertown, when you have this big influx of people that came in fleeing the Mexican Revolution, all right, they're coming here. Well, because of the language barrier, perhaps the education wasn't quite up. What were their opportunities?
What language did they speak besides English or Spanish?
That's about it.
That was...
But, you know, the thing is, Daniel, the cement plant and ASARCO offered higher paying jobs than what the city was, you know, what was available in El Paso.
I love that answer. That's about it. You know, English and Spanish, you know, because that really does reflect where the ASARCO, as we came to know it, is located, right there on the border. And there's this passage in the introduction where Dr. Chavez Leyva says that El Paso was, during that time, during the exact year, she says, but it used to be the Ellis Island of the Southwest. I'm wondering how that idea of El Paso as a place of, you know, welcoming families and immigrants and migrants from other parts of the United States.
The other thing that we interviewed Ellen Ramsey, who had taught in one of the little schools there. And one thing kind of sad to remind people of when you asked about languages is in those days, if a student spoke Spanish at school,
they got in trouble.
Was an infringement. these students... you know, there were a lot of little schools there. We interviewed some of the women that taught there. And in my in and out of the kitchen, some of the businesses the women did was through their kitchen.
Right.
So in those days, kids used to come home for lunch. Kid would come home for lunch, tell mama, you know, six of the school teachers need a lunch, mama. She'd pack six lunches.
Right.
He'd take them to school. So that was a little business for them.
And then the workers at the smelter, when they were off for lunch, there were houses they could go to and eat lunch there. What Mimi and I found so interesting, the kids that were raised in Smeltertown, they went to elementary and kind of middle school then because, you know, grade division was different. We had one man tell us, you know, I didn't know I was poor and Mexican until I went to El Paso High. He said right. We were all the same there.
Right. That's
and funny. So people ask us over and over again, what about the health ramifications of living by the smelter?
I was actually going to ask that. Perfect.
Well, here's what happened. You know that when the smelter ended up being like the checkerboard, like Ralston Purina, right?
That big tower that we used to see with the Sadco on the side.
Well, when it turned red and white checkerboard, that's when the EPA had started measuring the emissions, and they had to start adding to the height of the tower. Now, when I moved here in 1983, the houses were gone. However, when I would come back from a night class at UTEP, see, the EPA could only monitor it a certain number of hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as they quit monitoring, full speed ahead on the smelter. So I'd be driving home, I'd be driving west, and there'd be this dark orange cloud going over the freeway, and you could taste pennies in your mouth.
Oh, my gosh.
Now,
wow.
Mimi remembers those clouds, too.
Well, I remember, too, on the UTEP campus when you had the taste of sulfur in your mouth.
Wow.
And I also remember in Kern Place, a lot of those lawns in Kern Place got poisoned with lead.
Right.
And, of course, I cite in the book, and I loved it, because Arturo Islas, who was an important early Chicano writer and a professor at Stanford, he writes a scene in one of his books where Aunt comes back to visit the family in El Paso, and she says to them, what do you put up with this for? She says, oh, I know, they put lithium in your water and you'll put up with anything.
Wow. And I remember when I first moved here, I bought a house in Kern Place, and that was one of the things that they warned us about, that in the soil there's going to be some sort of effect from Osarco. What kind of effect did it have on the health of not only the workers who lived up in El Bajo, but the, you know, the management families who lived on top and maybe even closer to the smoke?
Well, here's the strange thing, and Howard Campbell remarks on it in the afterword. We didn't find anyone that we interviewed that saw this as a terrible threat to their health.
Wow.
None of them were
really
ill.
Interesting.
And think about it. We interviewed women who, you know, we took our time period from World War II, mm-hmm. when some of the women went to work in the smelter, all the way to when they tore the houses down, because we wanted to include the 60s,
mm.
when women were trying to raise a conservative Hispanic family, and then here they've got the sexual revolution.
Right.
Well, a lot of the women were, I mean, of course, all of them were alive that we talked to, and you couldn't get anyone to admit, Mimi?
No one mentioned health problems.
Wow, that's interesting.
No one. Not their children, their relatives,
Which brings back the idea of memory that I think it was Chavez Leyva mentioned in her introduction, or maybe it was your introduction, but, how can memory be trusted? You know, how could you really write about it? Because, you know, the memories can change. But it's really, I think, fundamental for me to understand that memory, in the case of these women telling their stories, you know, it's going to present, you know, their perspective, their lives, and their lives, you know, are ultimately really a lot of beautiful things happened in their life.
Oh, yeah. Well, and that's the thing. They have positive memories.
Right.
Marcia was talking about how the men would come down from the smelter and grab lunch at one family, opened a little cafe. They called it the Carrillo Cafe. And when we went to interview one of these women, they had a piece of the counter.
Oh, nice.
From the Carrillo Cafe in their home here in El Paso.
Wow.
So obviously this was, you know, the other thing that I think I want to be sure to mention is that those little streets down there in El Bajo were originally A, B, C, D. So many of the young men from El Bajo went to war and became heroes, and so they renamed the streets after the young men who had won medals.
And are those streets still there?
No, that's all torn
down.
It's all torn down.
But you know what's interesting when you're talking about memory? John Retchie, in one of his books, said this is not the sequence of events, this is the sequence of memory.
Absolutely, yeah. I love
so
that.
This is home.
And the memory is really how we give meaning to the past and to the present. Absolutely.
It's their home.
And it's a beautiful book. You interview a lot of women. You have a lot of wonderful photos, not only from Carol Eastman, who worked with you on this project and took pictures of what is there now, but photos provided by the women to you. Really beautiful book. And we're running out of time, but I wanted to ask you.
By the way, I wanted to add, we did interview some men.
Oh, awesome. Yes. But it's about the women.
Yes.
And just really one really quick question, because we have about 30 seconds left. So one or two words to answer this. What was the funnest part of the book, working on this book? The best part for you?
Getting the stories.
Talking to these women, they were just wonderful.
Oh, I bet it was amazing.
We were invited to a tamalada.
Oh, I love tamaladas.
That might have been the most
especially
fun.
The tamales part.
Which proved to me you don't undertake making tamales lightly, okay?
Right. I'm Daniel Chacon. I'd like to thank my guests, Marcia Hatfield-Dottestel and Mimi R. Gladstein. The new book is called The Women of Smeltertown, and it's a fantastic page-turner. I mean, you guys really told the stories well, and thank you for doing this book, and thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank my fantastic producer, Stefania Castro, and she is right now behind the glass celebrating because I pronounced her name correctly. I'm Daniel Chacon. We'll see you next week.